My name is Adrian Salbucci. I'm a risk management consultant for many years. I'm retired now. I'm 75, practically, years old. But I've had extensive experience in insurance, reinsurance, and risk management, which is very good for what we're dealing because it helps you to have a better understanding of geopolitics. Geopolitics has two main aspects. It's very long term and it has to take everything into account. So in a way, risk management as a discipline also has to analyze things and take them into a long term account. Now, that being said, I would also add that Argentina, where I was born and where I am presently based, I'm speaking to you from Buenos Aires in Argentina, has had a very difficult history. We've been very little in the news except for the last couple of years because it was a country that has been demonized or satanized, I should say, by the Anglo-American power structures, basically because during World War II, we were basically a neutral country. We did not side with either Britain, the United States, the Soviet Union, or France against Germany and its allies. We were practically forced to do so towards the end of World War II because obviously the Axis powers were losing that war, and we finally declared war, but it was more symbolic than anything else in March of 1945. After that, what happened here? We had a revolution, which is called a justicialist, from justice, justicialist revolution, that brought a very special and well-known political leader into power, Juan Domingo Perón. Now, Juan Perón was brought up and formed in the European National Revolutionary ideology. He learned most of his politics from being posted in Italy during Mussolini's time, and then in Germany during the National Socialist period. So, after the victorious Allies destroy National Socialism, save the world from all these autocracies and so forth, what does Argentina do? It brings in a brand new, shall we call it, National and Socialist party into power. However, it was not, obviously, for obvious reasons, an aggressive party. Perón was a very shrewd politician, and he said, I better not do that. He basically prepared the ideology of his own, he called it a justicialist, as I say, his own ideology, and peacefully brought it into the country. Peacefully, however, he was not liked at all because he brought in many German immigrants, especially scientists and people from technologies. He brought in aviation specialists, shipping specialists, electronics specialists, even rocket specialists, which was he created a hell of a loud noise at that time. So 10 years later, in September of 1955, he was ousted, basically by British and American forces operating in a very clandestine manner. From that time onwards, from 1955 onwards, the country, in spite of everything, never forgot or overcame Perón, and his influence was permanent, so much so that in 1973, and I'll round this off here, in 1973, he was voted back into power, but he died a year later, and it's been more than 50 years now since he's died, and his influence still is very strong, but it has been distorted by the Americans, distorted by the British, tried to place him as a right-wing extremist, which he was not, because basically what Perón did, and I think this is the last thing worthwhile mentioning, he created, instead of saying, well, we're going to be fascist, or we're going to be national socialist, or we're going to be this or that, he said, no, we're going to take on what he called the third position. And what was the third position? We are not neither left wing nor right wing. We just think in Argentina's interests. That back in the 50s and the 60s, so that ideology went forward quite a bit. But that third position was later adopted by Egypt It was later adopted by many of the Arab countries, notably Libya, and I think it's been adopted by many other countries who want to
Well,
be
like, I
enlightened.
mean, for example, Tony Blair has talked about the third way, which is the same thing. Anyway, look, before we get off the post-war immediately, I wonder if you can clear up something to do with the some of these top ex-Nazis, because there's a lot of talk. There always was a lot of talk about, because there was an expat community anyway in Argentina, a lot of Nazis fleeing to Argentina at the end of the Second World War. And particularly war criminals. But in 1996, this book came out called Op JB, Operation James Bond, it was short for, by Christopher Crichton. And he was a spy during the war. And he talks about bringing Martin Bormann, Hitler's private secretary and treasurer, over to the UK, commandos basically, in the first week of the peace in May 1945. And then Paul Manning is an American journalist from CBS. He writes an amazing book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, where he talks about Bormann's activities in South America, in Argentina and Paraguay, as someone who's creating all these companies into which he wants to launder the loot from Nazi Germany, that all of everything that they'd stolen in occupied Europe, going through Sullivan and Cromwell's law firm in the Dulles Brothers law firm in New York, and then secreting this cash, this laundered cash, into these businesses to create a financial empire. But so that's the Manning book, Paul Manning's book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. But then in the night about 98, 1998, another book came out called Grey Wolf, which is all about Adolf Hitler coming to Argentina. So at least if you believe these books, and I'd be interested to know what you make of it all, that basically the whole Nazi high command scooted over to Argentina. What do you think?
Well, there is a bit of truth in that, but we can't over-exaggerate. Normally, history is not just one answer, but you have different points of view, different opinions. But I think what is worth highlighting here is the following. Argentina has had, since the end of the 19th century, a sizable and then a growing German influx of Germans into Argentina. But not just Germans, also Jews, because the founder of Zionism, one Theodor Herzl, we can speak about this later on, he wrote a book in 1896, I think it was, called The Jewish State by Theodor Herzl. He is the founder of Zionism. If you look at any photograph of the Israeli Knesset nowadays, you will see that it has a huge photograph of a man with a long dark beard. That's Theodor Herzl. He's considered to be the founding father of the modern state of Israel. And what he did at this is at the end of the 19th century, he linked up with the Rothschilds, or one of the main Rothschild financiers, and said, hey, we should bring in as many Jews as possible into this wonderful little place called Argentina. And the Rothschild financier gave him the money and financed a huge influx of European Jews to Argentina, starting at the end of the 19th century and well into the 20th century. Now, this was way before Adolf Hitler or the National Socialist regime even arose. Then, first we had World War I, then we had World War II. After World War II, obviously, the State of Israel was created in 1948 or imposed in 1948, and many, many of the defeated Nazis and defeated fascists, both from Austria as well as from Central Europe and from Austria, emigrated. And many of them did come to Argentina. By that time, this is 1946 already. Juan Perón was president of Argentina, and he did not dislike National Socialism or fascism. So he said basically, and I'll put it in my own words, okay, the Americans are kidnapping and taking into America many of the best scientists that Germany had. The Soviet Union is doing the same thing. Well, I might as well do something similar. And he did. So just as Werner von Braun, the rocket specialist, went into the United States and single-handedly founded NASA, the North America, the National Administration of Space, etc. And the Soviets did something similar and used it for warlike purposes. Juan Perón brought in many important scientists. So, for example, Argentina had the very first jet-powered fighter, the American Sabre F-86. And the Russian MiG-21, I think it was, were very similar because they had been designed by the same people, by the same Germans. And we had a fighter jet called the Pulki 2 in 1947, 1948, almost in 1950, I should say, that was also quite similar to the Sabre F-86 from the United States and the MiG-21 from the Soviet Union, because again, they were basically the same layout plans that were implemented in Argentina. And similarly, we started, this is the only country, Argentina, that began a nuclear plan. We had a nuclear program that was disbanded only in the late 70s, in the early 80s, I should say, because it was an imposition that came from the United States after the we had a war with Britain in 1982, the Falkland Malvinas War, and democracy, so-called democracy, was imposed upon Argentina starting in 1983. And one of the conditions from the Ronald Reagan government and from Britain, obviously, was that we should totally disband any nuclear investigation, any nuclear progress, and so forth. And we had to give up everything to the Americans and other allies, Spain, for example, to make it more elegant and not make it so obvious that we were completely defeated by Britain and the United States. And since then, since 1983, I should say, Argentina has gone from bad to worse, and now is so bad. Things are so bad in Argentina that I personally define everything, and I'll close off with this. I define Argentina as an inexistent country. We do not exist as a sovereign nation at all. We have 47 million inhabitants that occupy a little place on the map that is called the Republic of Argentina, but we have no true institutions. We have no sovereignty whatsoever. Our presidents and our political so-called leadership are getting worse and worse and worse. And all we can say is, if we are not presently invaded, such as Palestine is, it's merely because the Americans and the Brits and all their allies feel, well, it's not worth invading Argentina. That looks awfully bad on the 6 o'clock news. So we'll just impose upon them who we want to be president, who we want to be ministers and ambassadors and congresspeople and judges and so forth, who's going to run their media. So we don't need to invade them. The Argentinians can do this on our behalf quite as well.
Well, welcome to neocolonialism. We have
Yes.
the Bilderbergers imposing leaders all over Europe and possibly the United States as well. So, welcome to the club. But look, I want to drag
Yes.
you back to Hitler and Bormann, because
Yes.
I mean, we know, don't we, about the kidnapping by the Israelis in a Britannia aircraft of Eichmann. I think it was 1961. Who was one of those involved in the Final Solution in Nazi Germany? We also know, I think it was maybe around about the same time, there was a World in Action program all about Joseph Mengele carrying on his agriculture business quite happily. He was one of the doctors in one of the concentration camps over in Argentina. So if you were to move into a house in Argentina back in the 1960s, you might have a Nazi next door.
Yes, sir. It was just as you say. Basically, what happened is that after the war, during the Juan Perón government, he was voted into power, democratically, a majority voted into power in 1946, after he made a very important social spontaneous social revolution at the end of 1945. 17th of October of 1945 is like a holiday. It used to be a holiday in Argentina because it was the very peaceful Peronist Revolution of 17th October 1945. Then in 1946, after elections, legitimate elections were held, he won by a landslide victory and became president of Argentina. But in 1955, as I said before, in September of 55, he was violently ousted by the Brits and by the Americans. Now, that being said, during his entire tenure in office, he was very open to refugees from the National Socialist states and allies to come into Argentina. Josef Mengele definitely was one of them. Adolf Eichmann definitely was one of them. Priebke, and there were many other lesser known figures. That's why I was brought up in New York City. I'm 75 years old, and I remember there was a little joke going around in my New York City high school saying Hitler is alive and doing well in Argentina, because it became a national, a worldwide rumor, so to speak. Never any proof, never any proof. However, yes, there is proof that other high-standing National Socialist Nazi, both SS and just plain party or Wehrmacht members, did make it down to Argentina, especially because they had specific scientific and technological prowess that made them a good asset for Argentina to have. Probably the best known of all is Adolf Eichmann, who came to Argentina. He was an SS officer, belonged to the SS. His boss was Heinrich Himmler. However, what they never tell you is that he was the liaison with the International Zionist Movement during World War II with the National Socialist Government. And the SS was in charge of working together with the main Zionist, the aggressively Zionist entities from the SS, saying, okay, what do we want to do? Well, we both want something. You want to get the Jews out of Europe and bring them some other place, and we, the Nazis, want to get rid of the Jews from at least from German-controlled lands. So we have a common goal. Let's work together. And the liaison was one Adolf Eichmann. Now, when Eichmann finally made it to Argentina, I'll close on this note. He settled in Buenos Aires. He worked for Mercedes-Benz, which is today the Daimler-Benz Corporation, who always had a very large industrial branch in Argentina. And he was working peacefully until in 1961, I think it was, on the 25th of May. 25th of May is a sort of the a public holiday in Argentina. The Democratic Government of Argentina at that time invited Israeli government officers if they wanted to take part in the celebrations of taking part on the 25th of May, 1961, which is Argentina's national independence day, so to speak. And they did send a Britannia, an El Al Israeli Airlines Britannia aircraft that came to Argentina with some Mossad officers. Now, these Mossad officers had already been following Eichmann's whereabouts. They knew where he lived, they knew what he was doing. They kidnapped him, they drugged him, brought him illegally into the El Al Britannia airplane that was waiting in Buenos Aires airport, and they took him away. This was so gross that Argentina filed a formal complaint at the United Nations I think it was in June of 1961, and the United Nations said, yes, your sovereignty has been breached by the state of Israel, and they told the state of Israel at least apologize, which they half-heartedly did some years later. But Eichmann was kidnapped, he was taken away, he was shipped to Israel, he was supposedly tried in Tel Aviv, and he was hanged in 1962. I think he was finally hanged, which is okay. I'm not gonna give you an opinion on that. He was Eichmann was took part in the Endlösung, in all the measures, even extreme measures taken towards the end of the war against the Jewish population, both in Germany and in occupied Europe and so forth. But he was taken illegally out. And this is the surprising part, Tony. He was the only Nazi that was really kidnapped. And one can ask, well, why, with all these former Nazis traveling all over Argentina and Paraguay and Chile and southern Brazil and Colombia, why in Argentina, obviously, why did they specifically concentrate on Adolf Eichmann? And I believe, and a lot of people here believe this, because he had a lot of information. And there is a rumor, I know somebody who has died, unfortunately, who knew Adolf Eichmann. He was also a German. And he said, at the end, just before he was kidnapped, Eichmann had voiced the idea that he would like to write his memoirs. Now, if Eichmann had written his memoirs, and this is my own opinion, I don't have facts to prove this, he would have no doubt have said, well, I was the SS liaison officer during World War II. My boss was Heinrich Himmler. And we were dealing with the following Zionists, Mr. So-and-so and Mr. So-and-so and David Ben-Gurion. God knows how many names would have appeared in his book, and that would have been a scandal for all the Zionists worldwide. So they said, pick him up, take him away, make a fake trial, and kill him. And that's exactly what they did.
Well, I would imagine, first of all, they'd say to him, this writing of your memoirs is, do you think it's really a good idea to see if he was determined to do it or not? Anyway, fascinating insight, absolutely explosive stuff, Adrian. This is why I love, to pick up on some of the history from South America. And the reason I originally contacted you is because of what's been going on right up the other end of your continent, a bit north of you. But look, I also have to pick up on Bormann, the treasurer, the Nazi treasurer, because I noticed that even Fox News, you may have seen this, you may not, but Fox News are reporting Argentina's bungled hunt for Hitler's right-hand man, Martin Bormann, has been revealed in declassified files. Files have revealed the bureaucratic chaos and reliance on press rumours hampered efforts to capture Holocaust masterminds. So this is like literally January the 18th. That's where are we? It's Monday.
20th.
This week, this story still rumbles on amazingly because Bormann was very interesting and very important, particularly because of the Paul Manning book which came out. We also had Ladislas Varago's book Aftermath, which was concentrating also on Argentina and Nazis that had been there and activities that were happening in South America and particularly Paraguay too. What he did is he came over 1972, I think, and he got photographs of what he believed was Bormann in the street in Buenos Aires and sent them back to the Daily Express here in London. Stuart Stephen, who's an old Bristol journalist, actually a Jewish guy, who was working by then at the Daily Express, had a front page lead on the Saturday edition of the Express. Martin Bormann found in South America, and there were pictures of him and pictures of him from a similar angle from back in the World War II next to Hitler printed in the Daily Express here. So that was 1972. Then there was a enormous sort of hoo-ha saying, oh no, that can't possibly be true, over the succeeding couple of weeks, saying, oh, Bormann's body, skull and body have been found in Berlin miraculously at the same time. But he was the mastermind, it seems, and he was working very closely with Churchill's private secretary Desmond Morton, which my book is about actually, the Traitors of Arnhem, looks very closely at this relationship between the Nazis and the British Prime Minister and his office at the end of the Second World War. So what about Bormann? Are these just rumours or not?
No, I would say the following. I think we have to be very fair so as not to impose our own specific views. I have my own views on everything regarding World War II, the German immigration into Argentina, National Socialism in Argentina and Chile, and so forth. Many things I see as favorable, for example, their scientific and technological prowess, and other things I would rather not talk about. Other things I personally believe are Zionist exaggerations because they needed to generate and create the Holocaust as the 6 million dead monstrosity which would shut down any argument whatsoever. Let's keep this in mind. You have normally when you have history, you have various histories. You have the history of those who are in favor of a particular regime, then you have the history of those who are against a particular regime, then you have dynamic history, because every day, as you are very well aptly saying right now, new information, new documentation comes about. And then you have your own specific opinion, which would be the fourth version, whether you like this guy or you hate this guy, and so forth. Now, there is no formal proof that Martin Bormann even made it to South America. Let's keep in mind that many of these people left Germany in a very clandestine manner. Many of them were assisted by the Vatican. Let's keep that all in mind also. So they were given new names. They were,
And MI6, I might add.
and MI6, because one has to ask, why did MI6 in particular and the CIA, why were they so interested in helping these Nazis get out of Germany? A lot of them, they said, "Oh, we've captured them. Here we have, I don't know, Albert Speer, and we gave him a 10-year prison sentence. Others we sent to the gallows, like Julius Streicher and several others." Okay, a big show was mounted, was staged. Let's keep that in mind. A big historical show was staged with Nuremberg, the 1946 and 47 trials, Nuremberg trials being the main things. And they said, "And we've got a really big guy who's Hermann Göring, who was sacrificed. He was, in a way, the sacrificial person in this whole thing." But many others, the ones that they were particularly interested in, especially those who were willing to cooperate, because Hermann Göring would not have been able to cooperate. He was too well known. It would have been too much treasury. Rudolf Hess, he said, "Well, he's a nut. He was imprisoned in the Tower of London after he made that funny flight in 1941, and so we're going to retry him with life imprisonment in 1940 in Nuremberg." And it is no surprise that his final death on the 17th of August of 1987 in Spandau prison in Germany, when the Allies were supposedly taking care of him, and during that period it was Britain that was taking quote unquote care of prisoner Mr. Rudolf Hess, he committed suicide. It's funny to think that an almost a 90-year-old man will hang himself from a doorknob, but no problem. Let's carry on. However, you had many others where there was a formal agreement that Germany would, I think, that Germany would surrender, and that surrender would include giving over specific technicians and specific scientists to the United States, to Britain, to the former Soviet Union. They were very messy negotiations. There were many mistakes that were made. They probably allowed many Nazi hierarchy members, party members, and so forth to leave, which should have been tried, and they may have killed others that should not have been killed, that should have been used by the United States. That being said, there is no specific proof that one can say, "Look at this book, I've got the proof that Martin Bormann made it out." Specifically because, yeah, we have, I know the book you were mentioning, we have photographs. There are also some photographs, allegedly, of Adolf Hitler in Argentina also. And they say, "Well, think of it, he shaved off his mustache, he was 6 years older, he did this, he did that, he was a very sick man towards the end of his life. So this is Hitler."
Yeah, all I'd say is that in 1972, World War II was much nearer, and also the newspaper industry here was a lot fairer. It was before the Rupert Murdoch smashing of Fleet Street. Our newspapers were in the post-war world reflected a lot more of scandal. They were much more independent of the intelligence services and of the government and the City of London, etc. So these big institutions, these big elite institutions had to play careful in case what they were up to got into the papers and the people got to know about it. So in the 1972 time, when Farago's over in Buenos Aires, I mean, this was a major, major, major scandal. Photographs back then are not necessarily the same as photographs in, say, 2000 or whatever. Where also the technology is there much better to manipulate photography. But look, what about just more generally about the the situation with the Germans and Argentina and the technology. Because I mean, you pointing out here a very important, which is what was in it for us to bring these Nazis to embrace them after all the killing of the Second World War. And the answer you've already begun to explain really was to do with technology. That the Nazis were in many, many fields way ahead in terms of designing jet engines, rocket technology, delivery systems for potential atomic weapons. But it seems to me the big card they had to play was the atomic card. Todd Ryder in the United States, in Massachusetts, ex-Massachusetts Institute of Technology, has done some extremely good presentations looking at just simply at the evidence that was in the newspapers in 1945, the evidence from various archives in Europe and mostly in the Americas and Europe, and most importantly of all is the archives that are missing. So it refers to a specific document, and then you go to find the document, and you find the document's been removed. Things like that, senior atomic scientists overseeing, SS people overseeing atomic research in Nazi Germany, are told by the historical record that they've died, and then they pop up in these documents over in the United States in 1946, having been interrogated, interviewed, and agreeing to cooperate with the Americans in their own atomic program. So it might simply be that rather than use atomic weapons in the war, the Nazis decided, well, we're not going to win the war with these, but what we can do is, give ourselves safe passage, etc., and use them as a kind of bargaining chip. What do you make of that idea?
Well, you've said a whole series of very, very important key points, and I would just basically try to summarize as follows. First of all, I was lucky enough to become a very close friend of a gentleman. I can name him because he died 20 years ago, Wilfried von Offen. Who was Wilfried von Offen? He was an army officer, not an SS member. He was an army officer who, for 5 years, was Joseph Goebbels' private secretary. So he had a lot of information. He was very cautious with what he said. He was a delightful person, very highly cultured and educated. And Mr. von Offen gave me a lot of ideas. He did this 20, 30 years ago, and I was probably not sufficiently mature myself, and I did not know sufficiently about these things to make the right questions. Now, that being said, the second thing I'd like to mention, and you already referred to, is World War II ended over 80 years ago. 80 years ago. So whatever happened, whether so-and-so got away or did not get away, whether he should have been caught and killed, or he should have been released or whatever, or whether he was taken over to the Soviet Union or America or wherever, or Britain, all of these people are dead. I mean, all the key people who were in the National Socialist government, at least during the war, not from 1933 onwards, which is when Hitler actually won the democratic elections, which brought him to power on 30th January 1933, but definitely starting 1st September 1939, which is when World War II started, which, what, by the way, was declared by Britain and France against Germany and not by Germany. But that's another point altogether. That's part of history's little mischief makers trying to change and make history to their needs. Now, that being said, what you are mentioning is what a lot of people, including Mr. Abel Basti, who has been investigating, this Argentine historian who has deeply, profoundly investigated the possibility of Hitler having made it to Argentina. Naturally, he would be dead by now. The story goes that Hitler, if he did make it down here, he died around 1971, 1972 in Paraguay. Now, all of this would point to those who believe that what the world is living through right now is a Fourth Reich. Not because it's Germany again, not because Germany has any possibility of imposing a Fourth Reich on the European Union or the world or whatever. It's not history repeating itself, but that definitely many of the characteristics which were manifested in one specific way when National Socialist Germany was in power, and they were fo mainly focused on winning the war, which they didn't. But basically, as you aptly said a few minutes ago, after they lost the war, and they say, okay, guys, shucks, we lost World War II. So what do? We either commit suicide, we let ourselves be captured, and if we are captured, isn't that better than just being here in Germany and being hanged in Nuremberg? Because they knew that that's what's going to happen to them in the long run. So let's try to make a getaway. And there were very complicated, labyrinthical contacts, which many of them went through the Vatican. Many of them went through the Vatican, and see if we can get a safe way into Paraguay or Colombia or Brazil or Argentina or the Muslim world. The Muslim world, which we should not remember, or with the allies themselves. I mean, after all, that's what happened. The best example is Werner von Braun. After all, I'm a great scientist. He was a party member. He had no choice but to be a National Socialist Party member. But what the hell? Ideology is not my strong point. Rockets are my strong point. And I just want to continue with my investigations into rockets. We made the V1, then we made the V2. It flies very nicely. The first photographs taken of from outer space were taken by a German National Socialist V2 rocket that carried a camera that had been designed, built, and fired by Mr. von Braun. So he said, rather than go home and cry it over, maybe I should work for somebody. And that's what the Americans said. Why don't you come over and work with us? And many other scientists did the same with Britain, did the same with the United States, some with the Soviet Union. Obviously, those two countries were at loggerheads with each other. But basically, it seems that the unwritten, maybe almost unspoken rule was, if we go and work with you, you have to stop persecuting our people. We'll give you all the lists you want who finally left and are living in Argentina or are living here or are living there. And that was held. That was abided by Britain, definitely by the United States, most definitely by the United States because they were interested in this, and to a certain extent by the Soviet Union. And we're not just talking about countries. We should think of Britain, America, the Soviet Union, and their allies, especially in the former Soviet Union. Their allies included Czechoslovakia, were major scientific and technological investigations and research were being made, even into anti-gravity flying machines. We're not going to go into that if you don't like, because that's a bit of
Well,
it's a
look,
bit of.
the technology, I think, of all of the technology, some of it probably was faked and used for disinformation. But obviously, nuclear weapons were an incredible prize to have at the end of the Second World War. And it gave big countries like the United States immense confidence to become very belligerent and dominant around the world in places like Korea, Vietnam, etc. There was even suggestions about using atomic weapons in Korea by some of the American hawks.
Let me
Sorry.
add something to that, because there is something that I remember this gentleman, who is a close friend of mine. He was much older than I was, obviously, Wilfried von Offen, who had been Joseph Goebbels' last secretary. He told me one day, well, they, amongst all the things they stole from us, they stole the atomic bomb. And I said, what do you mean by that? He said, well, we had developed three apparently operable artifacts in Czechoslovakia in a secret installation or whatever, just as Peenemünde was the secret place where they were developing rocketry with Werner von Braun. Some places in Czechoslovakia, I don't remember the name, and it's unpronounceable anyway, was where they were carrying out, near Vienna even, all their atomic nuclear investigations. And he told me we had three artifacts. They were taken from us. And what happened to them? And this is what he told me. I have no documentation to prove this. I want to make this very clear. He said the following. They took the four artifacts away. One was tested in New Mexico, and they said, well, let's stand far away in case this really makes a big noise. They detonated it, and it made such a big noise that I think some of the scientists, American scientists who were in New Mexico in Alamogordo, disappeared because they were evaporated. Okay, we know it works. Second artifact, let's drop it on Hiroshima. It worked. Third artifact, Let's drop it on, sorry, for, on Hiroshima, and then it was Hiroshima on the 6th of August, 1945, and Nagasaki on the 9th of August, 1945. They work. We've won the war. Obviously, we've won the war in the Pacific against against Japan. And what do they do with the fourth artifact? Let's reverse engineer it and see how it works. And he said they had to do that because the American Manhattan Project had resolved and solved many of the technical problems with using nuclear energy for military purposes, but they had not quite been able to find the detonation, not the mechanism, the detonation structure, which was a very specific. I don't know about this. I'm not a nuclear physicist,
Well,
obviously,
I can tell
but.
you the Fat Man plutonium bomb, which I believe was the first, I'm not sure if it was the Hiroshima or Nagasaki. This was a plutonium bomb which was extremely difficult to detonate because you had to have a whole series of explosive, a kind of lens of explosive material around the plutonium to get it to implode, to concave and go to a critical mass. So you had a kind of I mean, it is complicated. You're right, but you're seeing it. It's interesting because I was also told exactly the same story by Manfred Petritsch, whose father was a Nazi jet engine designer for Messerschmitt. Actually, he worked for BMW. Those engines were used in the Messerschmitt 262, and he told me exactly the same that this design for the Fat Man type plutonium bomb was a totally it was all put together by the Nazis, and then that was used by the Manhattan Project because they couldn't get plutonium to go bang. They knew the uranium type bomb was a very simple one, was what they call a gun type, where you're just shooting one piece of uranium into another that then goes critical. So yeah, that's fascinating. Absolutely. Well, it just corroborates what I've heard too. Amazing. And that
Right.
interview's up there if you want to have a listen to it.
Yes, I will. And that has a lot to do with especially because people have to understand that the Hiroshima and the Nagasaki bombs were very different. The Hiroshima bomb was a uranium bomb, U-238, and the Nagasaki bomb was a more powerful and more perfected plutonium bomb. Now, that technology, which had a lot to do with the configuration, the physical form, the physical shape and configuration to ensure that not only was a chain reaction started, but that it continued until a big blast went off, as happened in Hiroshima. But this is a very key historical point that we have to keep in mind. Germany was completely vanquished and surrendered. Actually, Germany never surrendered. The armed forces of Germany surrendered, but the Third Reich, the Deutschen Reich, never actually surrendered. It was not, the country was just split into four sections, taken over by the Allies, France, Britain, Germany, and the Soviet Union, and that's the end of that. So what would the who really surrendered were the German armed forces, which is okay, which is fine. That happened on 8th of May, 1945. Let's keep that date in mind. 8th of May,
Yeah, and who
1945.
took over from Adolf Hitler? Well, it was Dönitz who was commanding the navy, and at that time, much of this technology was sitting in submarines,
Yes.
said being sent around the world. So that's why he
Many.
took over. Anyway, look, we really must get up to date a bit. Fascinating though all this stuff is, and maybe we can resume our conversation another time. But I really want to get, if you can, in a nutshell, like literally in 5 minutes. In 2000, Argentina was subjected to a horrendous run on its currency. I mean, this was an IMF attack on the country, really, and almost, Argentina was a sort of experiment, it seems to me. And how do you destroy a country financially? Can you just t tell us what happened there in a nutshell?
Well, very briefly, because I know time it demands it. Argentina probably after Germany has had historically the highest inflation in the world. Historically, the worst inflation was in 1923 after the defeated Deutsche Reich after the First World War was invaded by, or was actually the industrial section, the Ruhrgebiet was invaded by France because Germany did not pay its dues at war reparations after World War I, and that destroyed the German mark. It went into billions and billions of marks, faster than they could print them. The story goes that somebody took a shopping cart filled with a germ with billions and billions of Reichsmarks, which were worth nothing, and it was stolen. Why? Because somebody threw away the money and just took the shopping cart, because the shopping cart was the valuable thing there, not all that fake paper. Well, Argentina did not reach that extreme, but yes, we have had major inflationary cases. None of them were as bad as Germany's at all. I think Zimbabwe had something similar, but we did have a series of them, especially over the past 50 years, because Argentina did not have such a bad currency at all. Perón had stabilized the currency, and it was quite well. And we just started, Perón started from another point of view. What makes a currency valuable? Well, its reserve. Well, what are its reserves? Well, it can be gold, but it can be many other things too. For example, food, if you export cows and you export wheat, or petroleum, oil, if you have oil, and so forth, as happened with Saudi Arabia, many of the Muslim states. Now, especially starting in the year 2000, there was a crescendo coming from decades before, but it really made a key point in the year 2000, 2001 to be exact, right after 9/11. We underwent a completely massive banking and financial breakdown. It collapsed. The currency just completely collapsed. It was really horrible. Later, the United States said, well, you need to have a little bit of democracy. Okay, they imposed by finance. They don't have to do it verbally. When I say that America and Britain impose on Argentina specific candidates or specific ministers of economy or specific policies, it's not that they do it in a militaristic way. They just say, let's see, who are your politicians? Mr. A, Mr. B, Mr. C, and Mr. D. And for example, the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a key organization in the United States of America, which has a sister think tank in Britain called the Royal Institute of International Affairs, when they see that a country like Argentina, especially a country in trouble, is going to have an election, they invite the various candidates over, and they did invite the various candidates of Argentina over to the Council on Foreign Relations, the CFR, as it is called, and ask them, well, if you become president, what would you do with your inflation? And each one of them would reply. If one of them replied, well, I would try to make Argentina's currency, the peso, stronger, well reserved, and so forth, try to make it sanitize it, make it better, and so forth, they would say, very interesting. Mr. B, what would you do? No, I would ask the World Bank and the international Western bankers, JP Morgan, Citicorp, all the banks, I would ask them, give me a loan. Oh, okay, I like that. So I like the sound of that. And what they need, what all the bankers, this is not the public sector, this is especially the private sector, what they need is for countries to go into debt, into massive unpayable debt, including the United States nowadays, because they've become part of the problem, but they control the whole thing. Okay, if you become president of Argentina, you will, yes, I will request trillions of dollars, or billions of dollars, I should say, as loans. And that is putting the country in shackles for decades,
Well,
decades to
I
come.
wonder whether some of the British leaders have made these sorts of promises in the past, because we're now plunging Britain into massive debt too.
Well, it's a global thing. What they used Argentina, and you may, I think in the year 2000 was one of the milestones, as an example, how can we bring a country to its knees? Because keep one thing in mind. In the present world, all countries, starting with the United States, Britain, the whole European Union, Argentina, Brazil, and so forth, we are all debtor countries. We are all in debt. Okay, with whom are we in debt? The whole countries and all the entire countries are debt. We are debt in debt with the private sector, with multinational corporations that are billionaire companies, with individuals, because they even go so far as to say, well, our heroes are Elon Musk, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, all individuals who we all admire because, oh my gosh, they have trillions of dollars. Elon Musk is a trillionaire. Wonderful, yeah, but it's all private money. It's all money handled by private individuals who can use it to promote political activity in other countries. In favor of Argentina or against Argentina, in favor of letting Argentina off the hook, as Donald Trump is trying to do with Argentina's very right-wing president, Javier Milei, or we can dump the country and destroy it as they're doing right now, they've been doing with Iran. So we have the money power because money calls the shots, let's face it. And it's not the United States, it's not Great Britain, it's not the European Union, it's the people financing not only our government, but your government. It's the people financing Keir Starmer, it's the people financing Donald Trump. And when you look at Donald Trump, it's very easy to tell that this is a different Donald Trump than from the first term he had. He is fully controlled by Benjamin Netanyahu because Donald Trump is a complete puppet of the Zionist system, not just the state of Israel. That's simple. It's the Zionist, the private money market, which is not just Zionism. It's Zionists and their allies. They all have a vested interest in making money more and more powerful, irrespective of whether they are evangelical Protestants, Catholics, Jews, or whatever, because money calls the shots. So one has to ask, all people, 8 billion people in the world live in countries. You live in Britain, I live in Argentina, others live in the United States, and all these countries are indebted in unpayable sums. The United States has a public debt of 30, almost 38.5 trillion dollars. You can't even write that down. You can't imagine it. So the people of the world are indebted. And who have all the money, all the control over the money? Small groups of individuals. Some of them are made heroes like Elon Musk and all these other millionaires, Bill Gates and so forth, and the major corporations and the major banks, which really have no direct face. Okay, you can say Larry Fink is BlackRock. Okay, some of them do have a face you can adapt to it, but mostly money is anonymous. It's run by corporations, it's run by banks. It's run by hedge funds. It's run by people who, in turn, finance and make sure that Donald Trump and Scott Bessent make it to the government. And when their term is over, they'll say, "Okay, we have to find new ones." And it's always easy when you have trillions of dollars in your pockets. It's always easy to find somebody, an employee, who's willing to do your work in their new post as Secretary of the Treasury of the United States, President of the United States, or Prime Minister of Britain, or President of France. So it's the private money overworld that runs everything, including so-called sovereign states, starting with the United States of America. I won't even mention Argentina. I won't even mention Chile because we're just little small fries down there. So when you understand that, you realize that the whole world is indebted to a small cliche of private owners and controllers of the money. It's not just a question of who owns the money, which is important, but who controls the systems that makes money flow. The Bank of England, the Federal Reserve Bank, the European Central Bank, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, which in the case of Argentina has us by the neck. It's a stranglehold, which is really killing us. And then you understand why anonymously they can run the world. And when some figure sort of, well, he made a mistake, or he becomes too odious on a worldwide basis, as it seems to be the mission of Donald Trump to really do a whole series of horrendous things. And then when the American people get fed up, they'll say, well, he's got to go. Okay, he went finally, or we killed him after
Yeah,
getting
but
drunk.
then there's a whole queue waiting to take your
Exactly.
place.
That's it.
Anyway, look, it's been absolutely fascinating chatting with you, Adrian. When I visited South America myself, I was always impressed by the way that if I talked about the United States as America, I would get chastised by the South Americans. And they say, no, this is America. So anyway, our America correspondent, Adrian Salbucci, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Whatever you say, we can carry on in this. Thank you for calling me and having me on your program, and my best regards to you and your family.